Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, cancer and heart disease now dominate health insurance claims. A firearms bill backlash. A claimed secret revival sparks fresh outrage over gun control. How stock fells are increasingly fueling South Africa's economic future. And Cape Town and Johannesburg now lead Africa's high-end property boom. It's Friday, the 10th of October. South Africans, I read, are living almost two decades longer than they did around 50, 60 years ago. But here's the rub. Half of those extra years are spent in poor health. Medical scheme premiums are climbing as a result. Preventable diseases are rising and employers are feeling the cost. And experts say shifting from crisis to prevention could transform both personal and economic well-being. I guess the question is, how difficult is it to do that? Well, I'm going to put that to Satish Anthony, who's Chief Analytics and Strategy Officer at MedScheme. Satish, a very warm welcome to you. So why are we living longer but not healthier?
Yeah, you're right. So we are living longer, but not necessarily better. I think the research that we have done shows that we're seeing an increasing gap between what we call lifespan and health span. So in South Africa, especially, people are reaching into their 70s and 80s, which is a great thing. But the last 15 to 20 years of their life are increasingly spent managing chronic conditions that could and should have been prevented. And what we're seeing is the drivers of these conditions, they're fairly consistent. You know, it's poor nutrition, physical inactivity, tobacco use and excessive alcohol consumption, and also poor stress management. And sometimes this is brought about by, you know, increasing lack of sleep. And it's these behaviors that lead to a lot of our lifestyle diseases. I think it manifests as about eight conditions, such as, you know, diabetes, type 2 diabetes, obesity, cancer. And these account for about 80%. Of all our medical claims, you know, and that impact is significant. You know, we can't get away from that. It's not just for individuals, you know, but also for families, for employers, and the country as a whole. You know, when someone gets ill, it affects our ability or their ability to work, you know, their ability to earn an income, and hence, you know, what the household experiences in terms of their financial control. And then at a high level, national productivity. So I think the challenge for us is to make those extra years, you know, as great as they are, we need to make them healthier years. You know, we need to help people manage the risk early, and we need to do this by very effectively integrating prevention into our everyday life, and then building healthcare systems that reward this good health, you know, not just treat illness.
Prevention is a good idea, but it's human nature to try and avoid something like that. How do we inculcate this new way of living into people's lives without making it seem onerous?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's a number of ways around this, right? I think for me and for us, I'd probably bring it down to a couple of things. It's the first is visibility, the second is routine, and the third one is awareness. So the shift to prevention for us, you know, it would start with making health more visible and making the wellness aspect, the preventative aspect, more routine. And if we look at the impact, for example, on employers and their employees, you know, what businesses could do is, you know, integrate things like annual screenings, your lifestyle risk assessments, even something as simple as a flu vaccination, bring that into the wellness calendar. So what you want to do is to move away from a business perspective, as an example, you want to move away from wellness as just a tick box exercise that almost becomes part of the business culture, you know, one that values early detection of conditions. And then it's this awareness piece for all individuals, but also, I guess, employees specifically. So awareness of what your blood glucose reading is, awareness of what your blood pressure reading is, and then the education that comes with that, and give individuals ownership of the health. And that would then allow one to take corrective action at a significantly earlier period than is currently the case.
Satish, no one's going to take exception to that argument, but surely it does come down to affordability, both for the individual and for the company. And often that is not achievable, is it?
We believe otherwise. I think if you partner with the correct partners, be that medical aid schemes, be that wellness providers, and you utilize the tools that can deliver this in a cost-effective manner, we can make it more affordable. Digital health checkups, on-site clinics, and keep in mind that the downstream impact and saving is significantly greater than the cost of delivering these tools and delivering this awareness at an earlier stage.
And is it your experience that companies are starting to see the benefit of that and are perhaps introducing that kind of strategy more effectively?
Yes, definitely. Because there is a benefit to these businesses too. You know, there's improved productivity, there's lower absenteeism. Individuals and employees being physically fitter from the get-go means that the culture itself is a lot more positive. And a lot of this is getting into the business lexicon and that paradigm awareness. And that's, we're definitely seeing the movement towards that. And that's a good thing. So what we now need to do is support that, you know, with more cost-effective tools, more cost-effective health interventions and the like. And that is the model that we are pursuing.
Do we have the right focus, I wonder? Reading the data, it suggests that cancer and heart disease make up most claims. I guess we shouldn't be too surprised about that. It does say something, though, about the direction of current health strategies, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It would come back to the behaviors that I mentioned at the start and our ability to change those. And what you're looking to do is, as I mentioned earlier, you know, it's the prevention of those, and the prevention starts with that awareness. You know, the five key behaviors there, you know, the what you eat, how physically active you are, your tobacco and alcohol use, and also your mental health. You know, those are things that they can be extremely difficult to change, but you need to try. You know, something as simple as sleep, for example, getting 8 hours of sleep a night. I mean, it's now been identified as a lack of sleep as a carcinogenic, and yet those are usually things that we would very easily sacrifice at the altar of either our work that we have to do or something else. And it's almost that mindset that needs to be changed. And once you start getting that right, then you're well on that, you know, what you mentioned, the strategy to achieving significantly better outcomes.
So just a quick one in conclusion, Satish, if we get prevention and access right, and you've given us a suggestion on how we do that, what's the upside then for productivity and growth in South Africa, do you think?
Oh, I think it would be significant. You know, and I wouldn't want us to narrow it down just to productivity and, you know, from an employer perspective. I think the impact on us as a society would be significant. You know, to have breadwinners that can stay in the workplace longer, a reduced financial strain within households, and the extension of health span, you know, the earlier point that we were talking about, where we're living longer, but we're also able to live significantly healthier. I think from a societal perspective, it would be significantly positive. And then there would be benefits, you know, to the economy, you know, the increased productivity, the positive GDP impact. I think it would be wholesale. And it starts with essentially those five behaviors.
As you said.
And the awareness, and the prevention from an early stage.
And it all makes sense, of course. The question is, we've just got to start doing it, I guess. Satish, Anthony, thank you very much indeed. Chief Analytics and Strategy Officer at MedScheme.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, the civil rights and advocacy group Free SA has accused government of trying to quietly revive the controversial 2021 Firearms Control Amendment Bill. It's a proposal that would have banned guns for self-defense. The Department of Police hasn't confirmed or denied the claim. Critics say the process, if true, violates the principles of transparency and public consultation. Free SA's Ruben Kutzer is with me now. Ruben, a very warm welcome. You've accused the state of secrecy. I'm interested to know what evidence you have that the bill is being revived behind closed doors.
There has been statements that have been released. We have seen in a recent interview or press conference that the acting minister of police had that it was confirmed that the bill is being discussed, and we've seen it from some of the bureaucratic groups surrounding government, such as the trade union COSATU, as well as the National Economic Development and Labour Council NEDLAC, that have confirmed that the discussions have been taking place. And that's really one of the major concerns that we have as Free SA. Like you mentioned, we are an advocacy group, so we are really just a platform for the input of South African people. That's our main concern, is that there's only selected groups of individuals that's being selected to have this consultation process. As you mentioned already, in 2021, when the bill was drafted, it was withdrawn in 2022 due to the amount of public pressure by civil society, by individuals, especially vulnerable groups that really rely on firearms for self-defense in the community that they are in South Africa, because we see that the government has failed to really deal with crime, and that's why citizens resort back to getting their own firearms for self-defense. And that's really our main concern, is that it's a selective consultation process, because such drastic decisions should be informed by a really collective, all-encompassing view of the public.
I don't want to get into a debate with you about semantics, but there is a difference between something being discussed and something being revived. And I'm just wondering if this just isn't internal policy housekeeping rather than a covert political move, as you're suggesting.
Well, even if it is just internal discussions, we have to look at what the rationale behind it is. Because, like I mentioned already, in 2021, it was tabled and it was immediately withdrawn in 2022 due to the amount of pressure that the public has placed on it. And I think that's really what we are questioning, is what has changed since 2022? What is the new rationale behind these discussions? And we live in a participatory democracy in South Africa, and we see that it's not just an issue with firearms. We see that across the board, with issues that affect South African citizens, the government really prefers to do it behind closed doors, even if it is, as you might suggest, that it is just maybe internal discussions and housekeeping. There has to be a question as to what is the rationale for that. What has changed since 2022, and why there is a need for this discussion? Why would we disarm our own South African citizens rather than dealing with the issues of crime? Because if you look at the crime stats, it's just crazy at the moment. We've had 27,000 murders recorded in 2023 alone, and that's just murders, not to speak of any other violent crimes like robbery, like mugging, and all a host of crimes that South Africans have to deal with on a daily basis. Why are the discussions to disarm law-abiding South African citizens who are resorting to firearms to defend themselves, rather than tackling the issue of crime directly, which is fundamentally more important? And I think that's just our concern, is that the government has this tendency to rather look at their own citizens first, who are just resorting to this as a means to defend themselves, rather than actually tackling crime at the root causes. And I think that's our main concern.
What do you mean their own citizens when you refer to the government?
I mean to ordinary South African citizens that are resorting to firearms to defend themselves, because I already mentioned the crime stats that we do have. We see that the police often do not arrive to deal with these crimes. If they arrive at all, it is not on time usually, and South Africans are then sort of left at their own mercy to defend themselves. And I think that's really the argument that we are making, is this attempt to criminalize self-defense is really just irresponsible and unconstitutional, because then it leaves our citizens at the mercy of violent criminals who really won't think twice to resort to violence. Rather than tackling, let's say, the illegal firearms that are pouring across our borders, that's something that's a huge problem in our country. We see that a lot of our border nations are managing to get in illegal firearms that support gang violence.
Right. No one's doubting the illegal firearms issue, or for that matter, the high crime statistics. But how does your organization respond to those who say South Africa's gun culture itself fuels violent crime? In fact, we need less guns rather than more guns.
But then we should start at the cause, where the guns are really causing problems, and not starting with ordinary South African citizens. I think everyone agrees that it's important to have a means of gun control. But again, I think at a root cause, the agreement is the same, but the means of going about it is totally wrong. to start with your very own citizens who are not the cause of violent crime, rather than tackling, as you mentioned, the gangs, those who are committing violence. That is really where the problem lays. But I think, as I mentioned, this is really a two-layered issue that we have. The first issue is disarming citizens of the means to self-defense. But the second issue is that it's sort of being done behind closed doors without consulting the public. Regardless of the intentions behind it, this is a vitally important aspect and legislation for many South Africans, and South Africans' voices should be heard throughout that, and it shouldn't be something that's done in private. And I think that's why we're really calling on the Acting Minister of Police and the Portfolio Committee of Police and those involved with the legislation to confirm exactly what is going on, if this bill is being revived or not, why and what the legislative rationale is for the revival of this bill. And exactly the steps behind it, because I think, as I mentioned, in a participatory democracy like South Africa, the citizens need to be at the forefront of the lawmaking. I think that's really the secondary issue, but that is equally a fundamentally important issue that we need answers on, rather than us as civil society.
Is there not a danger that your organization is simply advocating for widespread private armament?
Not at all. We just want South Africans to be included in legislation that that affects them. That's why, as I mentioned, we are just the platform on our website at freesa.org.za. We really allow the public to give input on these sort of legislation. What is the public's view on that, and what is the public's view that would be best for South Africans? And that's really what we want to do.
How much support have you got so far?
We've already had about 2,000 submissions on this bill so far, just below 2,000, I believe. And it's both people supporting the bill and opposing the bill, and that's really what we want to do. We want to get various points of views of South Africans on this bill, but I have to say it's been largely in support of what we're advocating for, that there needs to be a public consultation process and that we don't need to disarm our own citizens of their right to self-defense.
All right, let's see how this plays out. Ruben Kutzer, thank you very much indeed. Speaks for the civil rights and advocacy group Free SA.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's Stokvel economy, it was once seen as informal, is really transforming how capital circulates in communities. Listen to this. It's worth around 50 billion rand a year. And they've evolved from grocery clubs into real investment vehicles and funding hubs for women-led businesses who are perhaps excluded from traditional finance. With banks now formalizing Stokvel accounts and using them to gauge creditworthiness, a key question is now arising. Could South Africa's oldest savings tradition become its next growth model? Well, I'm in conversation now with Palesa Lenholo, who's product manager for Absa Personal and Private Banking, also co-founder of the Absa Stokvel Awards. Palesa, a very warm welcome to you. You've described Stokvels as a force for good in building generational wealth. How close do you think we are to unlocking their full economic potential?
Thank you, Jeremy, for having me. So Stokvels are the old financial system that is self-sufficient for many years now. And they've been used for necessities and almost, if I would say, survival. But there's been a growth and evolution that we are seeing in the market as people get more financial literate, as we are seeing professionals, business people clubbing together for different things. We are seeing people using this financial system, used to be an informal system, to funding businesses, to going into investments, to turning into even businesses themselves. And there is a great opportunity with using the Stokvel model, as we have seen in the countries like Kenya, that they've contributed quite a lot into the economy. And in South Africa, they can literally also do the same if they are more organized and structured and financially literate to be able to take advantage of the opportunities that they can get into as a group.
I'm interested in the evolution. What do you think is driving and has driven that clubbing together behavior more assertively?
I think it's first two things. Firstly, affordability. The living costs have become really high, even for the middle class. And clubbing together for necessities has not for the poor only now. It also just makes financial sense. Buying in bulk, you get discounts, so you get that affordability that you wouldn't necessarily was able to get alone. And then secondly is a quicker own capital fundraising. Stockfell's biggest, strongest strength is definitely raising capital. And the business owners that we are seeing that are clubbing together, whether it's to get stock for their businesses or to have cash, to always have cash flow in their businesses, are literally stockfelling. And then that's how we are seeing the evolution that is happening, that, oh, okay, people are using the stockfell system to actually solve their own problems as an alternative.
Providing, of course, they are managed transparently and that members are not exposed to either fraud or mismanagement. And therein lies a risk, surely.
Definitely. That is why it's important to make sure that you have a Stockfell specific account like the Absa Investment Club account, where this account is specifically made for people that are saving as a group, so that you avoid saving in somebody's personal accounts with the risk of running being defrauded. These accounts make sure that there's two people that are authorized, there's accountability and transparency in terms of communication of transactions coming in and out. That way, everybody that is part of the group has that security and safety. And most importantly, these accounts, they come with digital banking where you can literally transfer without withdrawing cash, which what we see a lot in the Stockfell market.
What do you think prevents Stockfells then from scaling up into bigger investment cooperatives? Is it regulation? Is it financial literacy? Is it trust? Or maybe a combination of all of that?
Honestly, it is a combination of all of that, but I will touch on the two main ones that I have seen. It's misconception, firstly. I think most of the time people, when you say Stockfell, they think burial and grocery. But somebody, when you say investment club, they are thinking, oh my goodness, let's group together and buy an investment property and we don't have to borrow for it, for example, and we can raise that capital quite quickly. That is still Stockfelling. You just calling it a club. So that the misconception of clubbing together and stockfelling together for people to maybe undermine the power of coming together and doing these great things. Secondly, is definitely with other entities like your companies and cooperatives, because they are formalized, they get funding from different institutions. Stockfell's power, they are always too dependent on themselves. Hence, at Absa, we've got the Absa Stockfell Awards that is literally giving them money to reach and enable them for their savings goals, so that they're not only depending on their own contributions. There is also an institution that can literally almost fund you via these awards.
Palesa, you talk about people stockfelling as an investment opportunity. I love the fact that stockfelling is now a verb, but I'm assuming that this can't happen unless it's underpinned by a good contracting.
Definitely. If you're going to be doing serious things as a group, like with anything else, make sure you do it properly, structured, professionally. What I always say to groups is that you need a legal agreement in place, not just verbally, oh no, let's do this socially, like how some social clubs operate. But if you're going to be getting into funding businesses, borrowing your members or investing in property, it's important first and foremost to have that agreement between yourselves as members of that group and have rules that will govern that group, and most importantly having a separate bank account specifically for that group to create that trust and transparency, and those are the basics that needs to be in place. And then lastly, of course, with group dynamics, it is also important to always make sure you are working closely or outsourcing or consulting with people like financial advisors, lawyers, and accountants, and just to make sure that as opportunities come, you have a professional foundation to be able to get into those opportunities.
And just a final one and a quick answer, if you don't mind. You've also highlighted women-led Stockvels as a real bridge to entrepreneurship, and this is backed by data from the World Bank, something in the region of $42 billion. There's a funding gap for women-owned SMEs in Africa. I guess Stockvels can close that gap. At this stage, though, it appears that they're only scratching the surface.
Definitely. As I said, if we can solve or unlock the misconceptions and the financial literacy and the funding to back up and partner with Stockvels. For example, Stockvels, 80% of Stockvels are run by women. So and the guess is that they would literally fund a woman business over any other because of the relation of empowering women. So there is an opportunity here to for Stockvels led entities to support and fund women businesses to contribute to the growth of the SMEs that are women led.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Palesa Lenkgolo, product manager for Absa Personal and Private Banking.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
On to property now, and South Africa's luxury market is defying the broader slowdown, it seems. According to Better Bond, demand for homes above 3 million rand has climbed more than 6% this year, buoyed by 5 interest rate cuts and renewed confidence among high-end buyers. Cape Town, predictably, but also Johannesburg, continue to dominate with record-breaking sales in Clifton and in Sandton. Foreign investors returning to the Atlantic seaboard, no surprise there. Well, let's discuss what's driving this top-end momentum and whether it maybe signals a broader property rebound. And I'm joined by Brad Bendel, Better Bond's National Head of Sales. He's been with us on the program before. So, Brad, your data shows a 6.6% rise in home loans above 3 million rand, if I read the numbers correctly. What's driving the surge when the broader market remains fairly subdued at the moment?
Now, hi, Jeremy. I mean, the main drivers are the interest rate cuts that certainly instills a bit of confidence in the market. Although, as you and I have spoken in the past, I mean, the interest rate is still probably 0.5% where it should, above where it should be. And then international investment, you know, that certainly also instills a lot of confidence in the market.
Let's talk about that international demand. How much then of that current momentum is local demand or just foreign capital that is chasing bargains at rand terms? And boy, oh boy, there are bargains to be had.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly bargains to be had when one considers the exchange rate. The rand is still fairly weak against the big foreign currencies. So that makes a big difference. But I think there's also a lot of pent-up demand in this sector of the market, and particularly investors and people looking for bargains, as you correctly pointed out, who've been waiting in the wings, waiting to see what's happening with the interest rate cycle, waiting to see what foreign investment looks like. And then certainly, you know, pressure comes in, the market incurs a bit of pressure, and then there are bargains to be had, and then the big boys come in and snap them up. So, you know, you spoke about a record-breaking sale in Cape Town of 157 million in Ettleton Road. You know, that buyer considers that a bargain, believe it or not.
You talk about interest rates driving the surge, but therein, I would suggest to you, and you know a lot more about this than I do, lies a degree of risk, because unless there is better structural economic confidence, the rebound doesn't necessarily have legs.
Yeah, true. I think, though, in the Western Cape, you know, the structural confidence is there. Better governance in the Western Cape is certainly something that's been prominent for quite some time. But I think also, you know, we're seeing better governance in areas where big development is taking place. And I think I might have mentioned it to you previously, for example, in Pretoria, albeit that the CBD is not looking fantastic, there's a lot of investment in Pretoria at the moment, primarily driven by, government employment, etc. So I think there's a fair amount of good governance happening. One can always argue that there's an equal amount of bad governance, but I think certainly in Cape Town or the Western Cape, not only Cape Town, but the Western Cape, there's great governance, and I think that the other cities are following suit.
And that, if I'm hearing you correctly, is a good thing, because there is a bit of market depth there at the top end, and not just isolated so-called trophy sales in Sandton and, as you mentioned, in Nettleton Road in Cape Town.
Yeah, absolutely, Jeremy. I mean, we're seeing depth in that sector of the market, both in Gauteng, in the Sandton, Hyde Park, Bryanston areas, where listings are ranging between 55 and 89 million. And then you're seeing, the KZN lifestyle with big estate living in KZN. There's a number of new estates up the north coast, and they are pulling high-end buyers with prices of around 5.2 million, etc.
I want to talk to you a little bit about Gauteng. You did say that, that Pretoria is showing a bit of recovery. Obviously, we've spoken about Sandton. But is it too soon, Brad, to say that the luxury market in the province broadly has truly recovered? Or is there still a lag and will be for some time?
There is a lag, Jeremy. And I'm loath to say that it hasn't recovered fully yet, but we are starting to see this movement now. And we're starting to see these listings of properties around 55 and 80 million. And those properties are starting to move now, which it's one thing to list them and to have them on the market. It's another thing to sell them because you need the buyers. But we're starting to see that. And that's certainly a mark of things to come, a sign of things to come. In Pretoria, I wouldn't say the luxury end of the market has recovered at all, although there's certainly investment in that segment of the market, but not significant enough to suggest there's been a recovery.
Brad, more broadly, is there a danger, a risk of over-evaluation at the top end? Are we in danger maybe of creating a bubble in that 10 million plus segment?
I don't believe so. I think properties are being valued more accurately than ever before. And certainly where there is finance involved, the banks will monitor that and govern that. But we're not seeing the pre-financial crisis run on properties over 10 million, where we had massive foreign investment flooding into the Western Cape, and property prices were being inflated as a result because there was such a massive demand. There isn't that massive demand. I think it's normalized, and so I think your pricing therefore is quite realistic.
I mentioned at the start of our conversation that more broadly the market does remain a little subdued in spite of the good news on interest rate cuts. So if you look at what's happening on the upper end or the upper tier, are there implications in any way for middle tier properties? So that ripple effect, Brad, is it starting to reach the 1 million to 2 million rand bands? Or again, is that divide still very prevalent?
Yeah, there is a divide, Jeremy. We certainly have a big, it's difficult to say we've got a middle class in this country anymore, but let's say we do. We are still seeing a divide. I mean, the 1 to 1.5 million sector of the market has strengthened. So we're seeing healthy trading in that sector. Still accounts for 20% of the total loans that we do. So, I think if the luxury market pushes up and strengthens, it generally does have a ripple effect. Although, we're talking about very, very different price bands and very different affordability sectors of the market. Your 3 to 5 million is still improving. We're seeing a lot of movement there. I think it's probably the funny enough, the 7 to probably 12 million sector of the market that's, for whatever reason, is not moving as quickly as the others.
Brad Bendel, thank you very much indeed. National Head of Sales at Betterbond. And that's where we are going to leave it for today and for the week. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.